before working it well on with the small flattish trowel. This process had to be repeated again and again because I took care always to make my layers overlap, for even a hairline weakness can render a whole section vulnerable to frost and rain. When the whole surface was covered, smooth as satin to the eye, I took out my mould and pressed it home. The ancient man, to whom I had been apprenticed, had once told me that in the old days, by which he meant in the reign of Queen Mary, it was the custom to hold a mould in place while one said five paternosters without haste. He had said, rather regretfully, "Now all is done by numbers," adding hastily, "Better so." It would never do to be suspected of hankering back to Tudor times, or of harbouring Catholic sympathies. Someone had worked out that a paternoster said without haste was the equivalent of a count of 30, so now I held the square of oak in place and counted 150. Then I priced it off. It would be wrong to say that I had rendered Anne Borley immortal, but well-made plaster, properly applied, is pretty durable stuff, and as long as John Mercer's house stood, there she would be, lovely and young. She and I would both age, and one day die. We should be forgotten. Or at least, well, I did entertain the thought that perhaps when my son was old enough to understand, I'd bring him here and say, "Look, that is your mother, as she was when I first knew her," and perhaps he would tell his son. I was rather old for such sweetheart thoughts, old indeed for first love, being a full 30. I'd always felt a rather contemptuous pity for fellows who fell in love, saved their pennies, got married, and ended up with a woman too fat or too thin, and a house full of hungry children. I'd thoroughly enjoyed my bachelor life. Because I was so sound a craftsman, and had acquired a reputation, I earned good money. While my mother lived, I'd kept her in comfort. Since her death, I'd been a lodger, sometimes in private houses, sometimes in inns. I could afford good clothes. I was singularly free to move about, for the poor law rules, which nail men, especially married men with children, down to a certain parish, did not apply to a man alone, with a well-paying craft in his hand. Then I'd come to Mincham, seen Anne Borley, and lost both my heart and my head. Maybe love, like measles, hits harder at the not-so-young. I slid the mould back into my tool-basket. That was too large to allow both handles to be grasped, so it sagged. I was descending the ladder when John Mercer rode up on his fine grey horse. He was not a Suffolk man. He didn't even look like one. He was a Londoner, who'd made his money dealing in woolen cloth and silk. He was already an alderman, and bad fare to be Lord Mayor. But one of his daughters had married a Fennel of Ockley, and he had come to visit her and fallen in love with the whole countryside. Since no suitable house was for sale at the time, he decided to build. "Morning, Adam," he called. "How's the work?" "I've just finished, sir." I slithered down the last rungs and moved the ladder to give him a clear view. "It's different," he said at last, "but I like it. In fact, it's beautiful. Has it any significance?" Even to his kindly eye, I did not intend to expose my partiality. I had set Anne's head in an oval wreath of flowers and leaves. "More mythical," I said. "You could call it the spirit of spring. But after all, sir, you did ask for the signs of the zodiac." "Ah, Virgo." He gave me a sharp look. "Well disguised, I'm thankful to say. I'm glad you didn't give her a halo. Difficult to carve, sir. In relief, and in the one colour, a halo would look just like a hoop." "You look warm, my boy. Come in and..."